Okay, right. Who has got any comments to make on any of the things that Paul said or any questions to ask him? Brian, I see you've got your hand up. Over to you.
Yes, just expressing an aspiration in regards to what the heck has this got to do with class struggle?
Nothing directly.
What's it got to do with class struggle?
Yeah, nothing directly.
Can I say that since nobody else has got their hand up, I found a sort of bit of a link anyway, because you mentioned Welsh.
Yeah.
You mentioned the status of Welsh in Wales, and I live in Wales. I've lived in Wales for donkey's years, and so have a couple of the other people here, in fact, for longer than me. But it's an interesting situation, socially, so shall we say, because what's happened over the years is Welsh has become used more and more, not as a spoken language, but as a written language. Just about everywhere you go in Wales now, I think anyway, I don't go to the north much, but certainly in the south, most notices of most descriptions are bilingual. They're written in English and they're written in Welsh. And some people say this is a terrible waste of resources. Obviously, it costs resources on a fairly large scale. And I can sort of understand that because while I can understand people wanting Welsh to survive. There's no reason why Welsh shouldn't survive if people continue to speak it, why it shouldn't survive as a spoken language. The fact of the matter is that a lot of the people who speak it don't actually write it. They neither write it nor particularly read it, but they speak it. Fair enough. Now, if it were the case that in Wales there were a significant number of people, or even any people for that matter, who don't understand English and speak English and read English and so on, then this would be it would be a strong argument to have everything bilingual. That happens, for example, in, I think anyway, in French Canada, where where people are essentially French speaking, they understand English, but they're essentially French speaking. So have things that are bilingual by all means. But it's always struck me that the arguments for everything written being in two languages really being wasteful. And, you know, it makes you wonder why there are some people, a certain number of people anyway, who are very keen on this happening, you know, the nationalist movement is, etc. And my explanation for this in the case of many people is one of what I'd call powerlessness. People feel pretty powerless in their everyday lives. There's nothing that they've that sort of allows them to express themselves, their talents, their way of looking at the world and so on. They're tied to an employer most of their waking hours. And this attachment to a language, the language they speak perhaps, and sometimes the language they don't speak, by the way, because lots of people who are keen Welsh nationalists don't speak Welsh. This attachment gives some kind of feeling of belonging, some kind of feeling of having power over things, which otherwise they wouldn't have. So that was the kind of connection I made to life in capitalism anyway, from one of the areas that Paul covered. Don't know if anyone else has got anything to say about this, but there are several people with their hands up. So initially,
can I say something about Welsh?
You can, you can indeed, Paul. Carry on, yeah.
Yeah. As you know, I visited Swansea sometimes for work, and what I recall, this is over 10 years ago now, is that written Welsh you saw mainly in areas to do with either the university or the council, and elsewhere, everything was English, really. I mean, do shops really bilingual these days with signs in both languages?
Some.
yeah, okay.
Not private shops, it's true.
And on a sort of related topic, in the centre of Manchester, on the edge of Chinatown, there's a small branch of Boots, and most of the signs in there saying what is being displayed where are in both English and Chinese. But there are a few examples which are in English only. And one of the ones which is in English only is family planning. I don't know if there's some profound reason for that, but it does seem to be the case, yeah. I don't know why. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, sorry, other people, yeah.
Fine, Paul, yeah. Right, Dougie, you're next.
Hi, Paul, that was quite interesting. I was just wondering if you know of any sort of tribes in Africa or Venezuela that, that don't have words for thank you or please or whatever. You know, tribes that have everything in common, really, you know, and they don't see the need to thank people for anything, really, you know, they just take what they need or whatever. I don't know if you know any tribes like that. Yeah, yeah. I think there are some. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, anyway, it was interesting talk. Thanks, Paul. Yeah.
I don't know of any people who, I mean, it doesn't mean that there aren't any. I just don't know of any who don't have words for thank you and so on. But, I mean, surely it's, you could say thank you to someone for being helpful, not just for, you know, giving you something. But, I don't know is the answer to that. You know.
Okay, Paul, your turn.
Right, cool. I will see you, Jimmy. That's all I can say. And that takes us back to the good old days of Russ Abbott and people out who used to take the riff out of the Glasgow, the Scottish accent in general. I found that really, really refreshing, Paul. I really did. I thought it was most interesting. And, of course, it doesn't help. Well, I'm sure if you really, wouldn't have to dig that deep to be able to see, you know, class issues at play there. It was really refreshing to have something a little bit off the beaten track from constant doom and gloom politics all the time. So I, for one, thank you kindly for bringing that to us. You know, if you're someone like King George or perhaps more recently Gareth Gates, who has had speech difficulties in the past, you'll realise how disabling it can be in modern mainstream capitalist society when you do have language barriers. You touched upon sign language and things, and of course there are other forms of communication other than just using hand sign language and braille, and there's pictorial ways of communication. And very often that's, to me, what it all boils down to, is the ability to be able to communicate effectively across all the various languages and such like. I'm thinking as well, you know, sometimes the snobbery that's involved in language, you know, I don't know if you've heard of that fellow John Barrowman, the sort of singer, and comes on, he speaks with a very broad American accent whenever you see him present programmes, and yet, lo and behold, he actually comes from not far up the road from where I live, was born and brought up in Glasgow. And he only sort of breaks spontaneously into his Glasgow accent when he's speaking to someone like Lorraine Kelly on a morning, you know, and there are a few people guilty of that. Sheena Easton, when she was the, you know, the girl that found fame on a programme called The Big Time, I think it was, with Esther Ranson, a long, long time ago. She went to America, made her fortune, come back, and she got booed off stage when she appeared at Glasgow George Square because she had this really kind of fake put-on American accent. A lot of its times, I mean, one of my favourite singers, Brian Ferry, in the early days, he had a broad kind of Newcastle accent, went to elocution lessons and now speaks with such intense snobbery, you know, it really is quite nauseating. But, I mean, there's definitely a political and a class element to speech and you know, they say that sometimes a culture Scottish accent, one thing that I certainly cannot boast in having, although I must admit, personally speaking, I've reined my accent in a lot from when I was much younger, and I went to live in England for a few years throughout my 20s, and I just couldn't be understood. So you had to. The fact that my dad was Welsh, my mum was German, although I was born and brought up in Glasgow, you know, and it's quite obvious I'm from Scotland and I have a Glasgow accent. But if you could hear and speak with some of the lads that I hang out with, I mean, you'd almost be forgiven for thinking that they were speaking some sort of Gaelic or Rabbi Burns kind of dialect, you know, such as the effect of it. But no, I think the important thing is to make yourself understood and having a play on language and such like. And maybe some of you have noticed that in the very occasional after I published the standard, I like to sort of not sort of two-way, two-way meanings to some extent, but playing on words. I can't remember off the top of the head some of the articles that I've had published and the standard, you know, but it's not the words of the same meanings, but, you know, spelled differently, completely different meanings, but the headline sort of draws you in and such as the nature of these things. No, I thank you kindly for that person speaking, Paul. I thought that was absolutely terrific. Thank you very much for bringing that to us tonight. Cheers.
Can I ask, do people in Scotland still talk about the Morningside accent as being the posh or the prestigious way of speaking?
That's in other words, the Fraser Anderson. If you hear Fraser speaking, you know, Fraser, anyone who's heard Fraser speaking, he's got a very posh accent, you know, and I've heard that a lot worse as well. And then, of course, you've got the likes of not so much Scottish, but who's that Tory politician? He's got his own, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Whenever, you know, and that just shows how off-putting it can be when you hear Jacob Rees-Mogg speaking. It's so, you know, he's got one of those voices and faces you'd never tire of bloody punching kind of thing. And that just shows how a voice can actually impact on your likability as well, you know. I mean, I dare say a lot of people love Jacob Rees-Mogg accent. For me, it just, whenever I hear him, I have to switch off because it makes me feel quite nauseous. That's probably a bit as much as politics rather than about the man. But yeah, Morningside, yes, all very, very posh. Cheers.
That's in Edinburgh, by the way, not Glasgow, for those
who
don't know the geography. One thing you said there about the political side of it, particularly with minority languages, things like the availability of interpreters and translators is quite an important question. So if you're in court or in hospital and your English isn't up to much, then in principle, you ought to be entitled to have an interpreter to help you through the court process or the hospital process. But I guess it quite often doesn't happen, you know, because probably, I guess court interpreters are probably rather badly paid and not always available. So, I mean, there's a political aspect to that, that minority languages are often underrepresented in terms of the availability of speakers. Quite often you can see sign language interpreters, can't you, when there are political speeches. I'm sure I've seen some of Nicola Sturgeon's speeches where there was a sign language interpreter shown either there or shown sort of in a sort of inset on the screen, which is good.
I was just going to say, yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, at the time of the COVID, a friend of mine who runs a legal practice specialising in disability discrimination cases, he had a successful class action against the government because they refused to include the sign language interpretation during the COVID presentations from Boris Johnson's and the like. So that's maybe a bit like say, it's a class, your typical sort of Tory kind of values, you know, don't really care who they include or exclude. Whereas in Scotland, they deliberately and purposely are maybe a bit more switched on to disabled people's needs in Scotland, but they had the interpreter all the time for during that. And everywhere, you know, any kind of sort of event or public sort of broadcasting, there tends to be sign language interpreters there. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Paul. Cheers.
Right, Paul, shall we move on to someone else now?
Yeah, sure, yes.
Okay, yeah. Can I just agree with Paul, Edward, with Paul about Jacob Rees-Mogg? Nauseous, absolutely nauseous.
Yeah, I think he's the most obnoxious politician ever, perhaps. You know, yeah.
Right, Paddy, on to you now.
Hi, I don't know. I don't want to get into a discussion about...
Are you there, Paddy?
I didn't unmute myself. That was clever, wasn't it? Don't want to get into a discussion about most obnoxious politicians, as we've just seen at the Tory Party conference. There's a few contenders. Thanks for that, Paul. I enjoyed that. I sort of sympathise with what Brian was saying, what's it got to do with us? I think part of the problem was probably for you. You had to spend so long sort of explaining the basic kind of concepts. You didn't really have enough time to sort of draw out any conclusions. But, I mean, the conclusions are all sort of in there. You know, there are lots of avenues that, you know, we could explore. I find this sort of stuff fascinating. We know language is historically contingent. We know it affects culture. We know culture affects how people see politics and, you know, therefore how they see the class struggle. I mean, you know, just for example, I mean, just take in the UK, how, languages or dialects have been siloed, you know, since before Roman times, you know, cut off from each other. You know, that's why there are so many strong and very distinctive accents in Britain, unlike a lot of other places. You know, simply because they've been cut off for so long. You know, until about the 17th century, people could walk 50 miles in the mainland of Britain and not understand a word that people said to them. There's a whole question there about, you know, has this historic siloing of cultures had an effect on, and possibly an impeding effect on, the potential for a sense of class unity? If you look elsewhere, you mentioned Serbo-Croat. I mean, another example you could have given was Hindustani, which was split for political reasons into Urdu and Hindi. And Urdu adopted a different script to make it clear that they weren't having anything to do with those filthy Hindus speaking Hindi. So language is incredibly politicised. I find it really interesting that in London now there is a thing called, which I thought you were going to mention, but you didn't, MLE, Multicultural London English, that started to sweep out old-fashioned Cockney. It started in the East End, apparently. I personally love it. I think it's an amazing sort of, mix of different of Black English and, you know, London Cockney English and Essex English and this sort of thing, all sort of put in a melting pot. And it's spreading out across the capital. And that's, we've seen that in the last 20 years. In the last 20 years, we've seen, or I think I've seen, a huge sort of uptick in hyper-correction that you mentioned in people using I instead of me, as in she gave the book to you and I, rather than she gave the book to you and me. Personally, that drives me bloody bonkers, but you hear it absolutely everywhere. Another one is upspeak, you know, where you go up at the end of every sentence as if everything you say is a question and not a statement. That's absolutely universal. I read somewhere that came from the TV soap Neighbours, but that may be apocryphal, I don't know. There's lots of stuff on YouTube about this as well. One guy I've discovered, very, very good at does a tour of accents round Britain and sort of eases perfectly into each one, is Dave Huxtable. Check out Dave Huxtable on YouTube. He also explains how these things work. You know, he explains the different. I think he must be a linguist, by training, or a phonologist, or one of these things. Very, very good at it. I also wondered about something else. Sorry, this is a bit of a mix. Before I stop. You mentioned egocentric versus geographic directions, and I thought that was interesting because I've always wondered how it is in American TV shows, cop shows. They always say he's headed north along 51st Street. And I always wonder, how the hell do they know where north is? In this country, we can't tell where we are because you never see any bloody sun. So we can't tell whether we're north or west. But then it occurred to me that maybe it's because a lot of their cities are laid out in a grid pattern, like old Roman towns used to be and Roman camps used to be. And that's why they know. But it also, so maybe that's why they know. And that would explain why in places where there are no road systems, you know, in open country, a geographic direction language would be more common because, yeah, the egocentric wouldn't wouldn't really work. Turn left at that rock. Well, which rock? So, yeah, I don't know. Just yeah, generally, lots of interesting things there struck a chord with me. You mentioned about British musicians trying to be American. Do you remember that film, That'll Be the Day, when Keith Moon says, "Now we can't do rock and roll. You've got to be American to do rock and roll." And that was very much the belief. And even now we get singers. I've got the singer in my own band. She keeps lapsing into American. She doesn't even know she's doing it. I get them to say, "Look, can you just stop being American, please?" Anyway, so yeah, lots of interesting things. Dave Huxtable on YouTube, I do recommend. Not sure how all this affects the price of coal, but interesting talk. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, okay. I can't tell you in the detail. Someone did look at these geographic systems and argued that it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the actual geographical environment, because they're used in different geographical areas and different sort of scenic spots and so on. So maybe it has nothing to do with the geography in that sense. I also read that someone who has kids can perhaps answer this, that children find it hard to learn things like left and right. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, somebody can perhaps answer that more than I can. The other thing you talked about, which you and sort of Paul mentioned earlier, is about language status. And a couple of weeks back, I had a letter from the NHS, and on the back, there's a bit about, in a number of languages, what to do if you aren't a native speaker of English. And it's in languages such as Arabic and Bengali. And the two, there are two European languages among these. I'd like to guess what they are.
Romanian.
No.
Portuguese.
Portuguese is one of them, yeah. That's rather unexpected from my point of view.
Polish?
Yes, Polish is the other. I mean, Polish I would have expected perhaps, but not Portuguese for some reason, you know. I've got the document here. The languages are Arabic, Bengali, Farsi, Gujarati, Polish, Portuguese, Punjabi, Urdu, and Chinese, with both simplified and traditional characters. Rather an odd collection, but anyway, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Joy's got a hand up. Joy, over to you.
Hi, Paul. That was a really great talk. Thanks. I was just wondering how much you think that the lexicon of a language reflects the society. My example is that when I lived in Italy, I used the word privacy, and I couldn't find an Italian equivalent. And search as I might, the result was that the equivalent in Italian for privacy is privacy, because they don't have the concept. And another small example was, I was trying to explain to my family a few weeks ago that I was having some decorating done. And I said, decorare. And they said, oh, and what they thought was I was having the place embellished. And I said, no, I was just having it. I had to use a whole phrase. No, the items are being repainted because they were past their sell-by date. So I'm just wondering how much you think that the actual vocabulary, the lexicon of a country reflects the attitudes of their society. Thanks, Paul.
Oh, gosh, I don't think I can answer a question like that. But, I mean, we have to use, and we use words like Schadenfreude from German, being, you know, sort of happiness at the misfortunes of others. I mean, maybe British people don't really go in for that kind of thing, whereas the Germans do rather more. I don't know about that. I mean, clearly a language vocabulary does reflect the society in which it exists, but I'm not sure I want to be any more specific than that. You know, I mean, I'm sure when, I mean, what Dougie said earlier about people who don't have words for please and thank you, I'm sure a lot of these sort of uncontacted tribes in the Amazon or so on, that they don't have expressions for a lot of the things that we talk about in English and French and so on. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, actually, privacy, if I can just think very brief, is an interesting one, because I think I can say from my experience of Italian that the Italians, the concept is sort of much less obvious there than it is here. The Italians just go in for privacy, whatever you call it. a lot less than we do. So maybe that's the reason why there isn't a specific word for it, which would tend
I suppose Sir Pugh and Wolfe would have said it the other way around, because there's no word, therefore there's no concept. But I think we can probably agree that that's nonsense, really, isn't it?
Okay, over to Brian now. Brian?
Yes, I forgot to... No, I am. Just... I remembered about 10 minutes ago now, there is such a thing in Wales which is called Wenglish, which is a combination of Welsh, right, and English. And it is, if you can't Google it, I mean, I just Googled it myself. I'm just looking for it now. Wait a minute.
Is that Wenglish, Brian?
Wenglish. Wenglish, I'll just I'll give you the introduction now. Welsh, English, Welsh, Saesnigs Cymraeg, right, which is Welsh English, right, or English Welsh there, sorry, comprises of dialects of English spoken by Welsh people. The dialects are significantly influenced by the Welsh grammar and often include words derived from Welsh. In addition to the distinctive words and grammar, a variety of accents are found across Wales, including those of North Wales, the Cardiff dialect, the South Wales Valleys, and West Wales. Accents and dialects in the west of Wales have been heavily influenced by the Welsh language, while dialects in the east have been influenced more by dialects in England. In the east and southeast, it has been influenced by the West Country and West Midlands dialect, while in northeast Wales and parts of North Wales, of the North Wales coast, it has been influenced by Merseyside English. A colloquial portomonym word for Welsh English is Wenglish. It has been in use since 1985. And if I remember correctly, there was a teacher. I'm not sure whether he was teaching English or Welsh. I think he was teaching English, but he produced a tape on it, and it had a very big distribution as well. Right. I don't know if you heard anything about that, Paul.
No, is the short answer. No. I know people talk about franglais, meaning French with lots of English in it, but I think that's mostly English words, isn't it, rather than anything else, rather than any... impact of English vocabulary, of English grammar and so on.
Say that the use of English words, it's the use of Welsh words as well.
Sorry. I was talking about French with English in it rather than...
Brian, I have got a glossary, actually, which for some reason I keep in my car, which is a glossary of Wenglish, precisely. And it's words that are used... specifically in Wales, or more specifically in Wales, which aren't used in other parts of the UK, which are something to do with either with Welsh or the way English is spoken in Wales. I have to say, if I can, there's nobody else with a hand up at the moment, that I've lived in Swansea for a long time now. When I first came here, I remember noticing that I could be in the city centre and hear people speaking, say, some way off, and not being able to hear what they were saying because they were too far away, and not knowing whether they were speaking Welsh or English, because their intonation, because their way of speaking sounded Welsh. I mean, almost 100% when I got closer, I realised they were speaking English. But nevertheless, the way they were speaking English, their intonation, the way the sort of sounds went up and down and stuff, made it sound very much like the kind of Welsh you might hear, say, on television or amongst people who are actually speaking Welsh. And I remember my little grandson, a good number of years ago now, was visiting me, and we walked across the university where various people were doing jobs, building jobs and painting jobs, maybe, workmen sort of chatting to one another, shouting to one another and so on. It was all English. And we walked past them. And at a certain point, he turned to me and said, "They're all speaking Welsh." Of course, none of them were speaking Welsh at all. But nevertheless, the way they were speaking made it sound like a foreign language to him. So, yes, there's some sort of interesting phenomena which can be observed here. And it, all the more the case, I would say, in Scotland as well, of course, where the accents can be, you know, far stronger, as it were, as already been pointed out.
Just talking about, not about Welsh, we're talking about language status. A few years ago, a friend of mine went to Bilbao in Spain, which is in the Basque-speaking area, and she told me that she wasn't aware of having heard or seen any Basque in Bilbao. I don't know how reliable that is, but possibly, you know, that it's used, but maybe it's only used in the home or something, or in schools rather than in sort of public. I don't know. But
certainly, can I say, in Italy, a lot of people speak, who in their everyday lives speak ordinary Italian, right? Ordinary Italian. In the home, they speak dialect, Italian dialects, which can be very different indeed from the standard language. Different languages, effectively, different forms of Latin.
Yeah, I do it. I remember once being in Stuttgart in Germany, and I think it was in a cafe, and the people at the next table were saying, "Okay, we'll speak German, not Swabian." Swabian being the local dialect, and I think quite different from standard German. And I don't know who they were or who they were. Perhaps some of them were Swabians and some weren't, I guess. You know. Yeah.
Any other observations? Few people have spoken. There are quite a few who haven't, however. Anyone, any connection? Adam, you make a connection, I'm sure, between language and society. Over to you.
Well, actually, I was going to ask about something that Paul said at the end. He said, this will be difficult for most people. And he talked about Adam's apple. Now, I understood that women don't have Adam's apple. That's why it's called Adam's apple. So how can women say B?
Perhaps a woman here could answer that.
Sorry, Adam, how can women?
Paul said at the end, to pronounce B, people should put their hand on their Adam's apple.
Oh, yes.
But if women haven't got an Adam's apple, I don't know, maybe they have, maybe I'm wrong anatomically, but
you don't put your fingers on your throat to pronounce it. You put your fingers there to feel the difference in how you pronounce it. And I think women probably can feel that, even if they don't have quite such a protuberance in the middle of their throat. They have the vocal cords, which produce the voicing. It's just not so obvious. Could a female colleague please confirm this for us?
There aren't many here, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Joy says yes. Right.
Okay. Yes to what?
Yes, it's different.
Can you feel the vibration with a burp sound?
Yes. Slightly, yeah.
Slightly, yes, yeah. Yeah. It's not so prominent as it is with men,
no.
But it's there.
No.
Yeah. Good.
While we're talking about the way women speak, you also mentioned that more women speak receive pronunciation than men. I've got to be careful what I say here, but isn't this because women tend to be more social climbers than men?
Well, that's what I said. I didn't phrase it in quite that way, Adam, but I did say that women tend to be more conscious of social status. I don't know if that makes them social climbers or not, really. I mean, there are different views on this, and it's, as I said, a bit of a minefield, that men are more interested in sounding masculine and blokish. So they drop their H's and say, "Un it," and use glottal stops, "Un it." Whereas women are more concerned with being refined and speaking properly and so on. But all these things are a matter of degree, and people vary, of course. But, Didn't Margaret Thatcher have to undergo speech, I don't know, allocution lessons to sound less posh or less nasty or something? I forget, really.
Next, Paddy, I'm sure you pushed back on that. Over to you.
Actually, I was going to remind you all again to go and check out Dave Huxtable, because he actually covers this point. He says that in his tour of English accents, I think it's Geordie, he says that the male Geordie speech pattern is quite muted. It's really not very exaggerated at all, and he gives some examples. And then he does the female Geordie pattern, and it's much more pronounced. It's very much stronger Geordie. They go, it's I can't explain it, but the sort of Geordie pronunciation is much more accented in the female version than in the male, which would sort of give the lie to the idea that, you know, women are sort of, you know, more social conformist or something like that. And just while I'm on, I was interested by what Paul said about John Barrowman. I didn't know he was born in Glasgow, and I looked him up in Wikipedia, and he actually mentions why he was that he sort of learned this kind of transatlantic American speech, and it wasn't to get on as a sort of celebrity. It was because he got bullied in American schools for his Scottish accent, so he had to unlearn it and to learn to speak like them. So kind of interesting as well. So why people speak the way they speak, I don't think it's not always to do with, you know, kind of social aspiration. There'll be other things going on.
Okay, can I make one other point about local speech patterns? I didn't talk about any of the applications of linguistics, but one is there's an area called forensic linguistics, which is to do with legal things and things like identifying people's accents and trying to identify who speakers are. And the best known recent example, people remember this, is the Yorkshire Ripper hoaxer, Wearside Jack. Yeah. And people were able to identify fairly closely where he came from. Yeah. But the general view is that that's much harder than it used to be, because people move around a lot more now and are subject to far more influences from other people's, from people with different accents and so on. So maybe strictly local accents are becoming less common and less pronounced. And maybe that's what this multicultural London English is, sort of a mishmash of everybody else's speech and so on. I don't know.
Is that Vincent, VJ?
Yes.
Okay.
What I was going to say, a couple of things actually. You're saying about Basque. I mean, I was working in the Basque Country, crumbs, well over 40 years ago, and Basque was there were certainly enclaves where Calais, where Basque was spoken a lot. But I guess 40 years ago, it was more of a political thing, because Basque Country was in sort of more of a struggle, and certainly places like Urquijo, there'd be lots of political posters of Basque prisoners. So if it's not spoken now, I guess that might be a reflection of the politics. The other thing that I was going to say, the ubiquity of Portuguese. Portuguese, there used to be a kind of maybe supercilious attitude towards Brazilian Portuguese, but because so many Brazilian soap operas are shown in Portugal now as like cheap telly, a lot of Brazilian Portuguese is now, a lot of Brazilian Portuguese words are spoken in Portugal. Those are the comments I would make.
Yeah, okay. I don't know whether the Portuguese on this letter is Portuguese or Brazilian Portuguese. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I like your picture, by the way, Vin. I don't know if people who aren't linguists might not sort of get it, but It says je participe, tu participes, but it means I participate, you participate, he participates, we participate, you participate, they profit, they gain. Yeah, it's a good socialist message, that, yeah. Well,
thank you.
Adam.
Yeah. Can I raise a more serious point about bilingualism? I think most people in the world must be at least bilingual. It's only in a place like England and America that people can only speak one language. But as I say, most people are bilingual, and that would be an ideal for a socialist society. Otherwise, one particular language will be the dominant one. I mean, presumably there have been studies of this.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a lot of studies of bilingualism, and I mean, in the States, there are plenty of Spanish English bilinguals, aren't there? But obviously, most people, I'm sure, are monolingual English speakers. I think all English is already the world language, to be honest, and it'll be even more so by the time socialism is established, frankly. Although I guess I'm sure other languages will survive alongside it, but
I have read that the majority of the world's population is at least bilingual, and a good many are trilingual, in fact.
Yeah,
that's absolutely right, point Adam made. Paddy, over to you.
Come back on that point that Adam was making about people being bilingual. It's true. I mean, I think... I think this country, or the Western world, I suppose, is a bit unusual in Western Anglo-Saxon world in not having to learn any other language. So therefore, we all think it's difficult, whereas to most other people in the world, it's just a matter of course that you do. I think AI is going to make quite a difference here. And it certainly could do in socialism. I can imagine a situation where, if you remember that book, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, and they all stick this thing called a Babel fish in their ear, and it translates any language into their own language and somehow manages to translate back the other way when they speak. He did that for a joke, just to make the point that people understood each other better than they'd ever understood each other in all of human history, and this caused bigger and bloodier wars than all of human history as a result, not to make a good joke. But in socialism, I can imagine, it's all using some AI equivalent of the Babel fish, which paradoxically would then mean that you may very well see greater speciation of languages, where languages split up into different dialects and become their own languages and this sort of thing, because it wouldn't matter. There wouldn't need to be a sort of dominant global language at that point. So, you could argue that technology might send things back the other way, and that would make things very interesting for linguists.
Thanks, Paddy. Close to 9 o'clock. Does anybody else wish to say anything, make any comments, ask any questions? Steve, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, just a question about the fact that you mentioned the Chinese being involved in Tibet.
It was Mongolia I mentioned.
I apologise, Mongolia. For pretty obvious political reasons. And it's not the first time the states have done this, is it? Wasn't it the case that Welsh was banned in schools in the past, and that is a genuine question. I'm not sure. I think so. And in the past, for example, the French state has made put a lot of effort into suppressing things like Breton and other regional languages, and I'm pretty sure in the case of France that in the national education system that these local languages were actually banned. I do wonder about the way that language is going in terms of politics, because when you look at the way that the political debate is being framed in this country, or well, not just in this country, you seem to have now rather than much in the way of political debate, you seem to have things being reduced to three bloody words: get it done, or yes, we can. And this has even gone over into Spanish, where you've got, and they've made it even briefer. And they've got a thing called Podemos. Yes, we, and that's the name of the political party, and that's their slogan: Podemos. Yes, we can. So they've taken the, and this occurred in South America as well, with in Argentina, where they reduced it to two words, which is si podemos. But in Spain they went one further, and it just seems to be that for example, last night ended up having a discussion with a relative, and he said. I gave him my season ticket to go to watch Bolton tomorrow because I'm at the EC meeting, and of course as soon as I said that, he said, oh yeah, you're on committee, aren't you? And a bit of a piss take, and then it developed into a political discussion. But straight away, he went for language that he'd heard before. Oh, you walk, are you? And right, and I'm thinking, well, I don't actually know what that means. But these words are somehow directing, you know, going back to Orwell, you know, that love is hate and war is peace and all that sort of shit. The way that people are being directed to think with some of this terminology. Now, whether, you know, and then, right, now, I might be completely bonkers here, but when it occurred to me this morning, he's gone, on the committee, right, now, some of you older buggers will probably remember the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club. And there was a comedian on there called Colin Crumpton. And one of his lines was, he used to go on about the committee, I'm sure I'm completely paranoid here, but it happened to be on ITV. So here we've got a Northern working class comedian taking the piss out of clubs, working men's clubs and institute clubs that were organised by committees. Was it something that's encouraged by a private enterprise broadcaster to attack these independent working class organisations? Yeah, I've gone completely bonkers. But thank you very much for your talk, Paul.
You've gone a long way from everything there, Steve.
It's mentioned, isn't it, in the editorial in this month's Standard, that whether you talk about refugees or asylum seekers or economic migrants, may well affect how people view them.
Yeah, quite.
In principle, those are different categories, but they're often all clubbed together.
And the word Howard used when he was taking his grandchild around the campus. He talked about workmen. That's what my aspiring ex-mother-in-law used to talk about. And I've told my kids, they're not workmen, they're men. So there, Edward.
Okay. Criticism accepted, yeah. Right, one more go, Brian. Go on.
Yes. in answer to Steve's question, whether a language is banned, and he said specifically Welsh. Welsh wasn't actually banned, right? What happened was it was discouraged, and it was certainly not used in education. Right? A thing was brought out called the Welsh Knot, right? With the K-N-O-T. And it was as part, say, again, on the Wenglish, right? Because it was, what it actually meant was not to speak Welsh, right? In the school. So if kids were heard speaking Welsh in the playground, you know, they weren't allowed to speak Welsh in the classroom, they were discouraged from speaking it in the playground. And if they were heard, they were given the Welsh knot, which meant they were given the old stick, like, you know, so they were punished for speaking the language in schoolyard. Like, that's just a little bit of information you might like to know.
Thanks, Brian. Okay. Adam, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, just to follow up what Brian has just said. When I went to school in North Wales, and it was 80%, 90% Welsh-speaking. I didn't realise that at the time. But in the playground, there's a game that you play in English. It's called What's the Time, Mr. Fox? But for me, it's Van der Gloch, Mr. Blythe. I mean, that's so that by that time, I'm talking about the 1950s now, Welsh was still taught in some schools in Anglesey.
Okay. Well, should we draw the proceedings to a close? Do you want to sum up, Paul, or you don't have to, or not?
I'll just say merci beaucoup, vielen Dank, sicher.
Fine, okay. And can I add that I think, if I'm not mistaken, next week's session is a what's in the news, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Right, so see you all next week, 7:30.
Paul forgot to say Jock and Val.
Right.
Oh, Jen, call your dogs, yeah.
Good one. Yeah.
And as we see in Glasgow, see you later.
Okay. Cheers. Thanks, Paul.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Escherichasco.
Arrivederci.